system, save you for a time. So when you've made a system, it is not eternal. It only works for a time. So the ordinal perfection system has a term. And then there arises a state called 11, the unluckiest number in the world. Because it means 1 over 10. The individual who can see that that system has come to its end. And the Tao Te Ching, it says, at the 11th hour, the sage removes himself. Because the state is about to totter. So somebody will build up a firm. And when that firm has reached a certain peak of production, if he's a very astute man, he'll say to the boss, look what I've done for you, I've built up this firm, but my ambitions know no bounds, I'm leaving. He leaves, shortly afterwards the firm collapses. If the boss doesn't know what's happened, he will think that he depended on that man. But the thing is finished. If that man had stayed, it would have gone down yesterday. So the 11th hour is very important. You'll find that 11 is running through the world historic process all the time. In the 11th century, certain things happen. In the 22nd century, some other things, just like the ones in the 11th century, are going to happen. The sunspot cycle is 11 years. And it is related to certain rhythms on the earth. Certain things happen on the earth because there is a constellation of forces moving into the earth and disposing the energy inside the body of humanity as a whole, so that mass movements occur according to these constellated forces pressing onto the earth. And if you look through your newspapers periodically at major historic events, you'll be surprised how often the number 11 occurs in major events. Of course, the most commonly known one is the 2 minutes silence on the 11th of the 11th of the 11th. These things are fixed by the spiritual intelligences, inherently by their natural movement, their spontaneous movement. And those people of the governing bodies who know about it always try to make their dates conform to those, because if they don't, they will fail. Thus the Queen, for instance, has a natural birthday as a ram, but her official birthday is in Gemini. Why? Because Gemini means to disintegrate. And because they intended to disintegrate the empire, they made her reign a period of disintegration and gave her an official disintegrating birthday. If you remember D-Day, it was the sixth hour of the sixth day of the sixth month. And 666 is the number of the beast in Revelation. And you remember they defined Hitler for the purpose of the time as the beast of the Revelation. A monstrous figure, the state, the Nazi state. And they deliberately make these numbers because it is essential to keep the thing in phase with reality. If it gets out of phase with reality, it will fail. So when we come to look at this very quickly, go around, we see that the 12 means governmental perfection. You can then see why there are 12 disciples, 12 hours of the day, why there are 12 in the Curia Romana, why there are 12 in most of the major governmental bodies of the world, and why the British will not let go of the 12 count, although the decimal count is so much easier. Because the 12 is an automatic evolute of the 3-4, that is, of the threefold partition of the four signs of the zodiac. And it is twice 6, and 6 is the spontaneous division of the circle. And you can do things with 12 geometrically that you can never do with 10, which is why our geometricians cling to the 12 count, whereas the arithmeticians prefer the decimal because it's for babies. So this means governmental perfection, because government means triumph of spirit over matter, of active over passive. In every statement of law, there is an assumption that there is a power, active, and a substance, passive. That's the basis of it. That must finite in order to create. So unity, oneity, vanity, if you like, it's the same word, finiting, commits you either to remain one and therefore valueless, because there's no relation and value depends on relation, or to develop by analysis. The analysis forces you to synthesize, to get back a relation that didn't exist in the unity. We call this a pre-synthetic unity, a whole. This is a synthetic unity. That is, a unity that's been analyzed and put back together again. So if we look at this as the A from which you are derived, then the primary polarization, then the link factor set up in the three, we see how these three arise, and how this is a buffer between these two, between prime edge, bang, and intellection saying that shall not, and how in the feeling zone we try to resolve the conflict between more, appetite, and reason, all symbolized in this sign, the karab. The karab is to create, krabbe is simply create in the house of body. How that establishes itself on the earth as a volitional being, grows itself five sense organs, the growth of the human eye, if you watch the morphology of it, how it changes, how it pushes itself up and folds itself, and by simply folding and changing its chemical constitution, it makes an eye. The form is at the back of it, pushing that matter, creating organs of function. Always teleological, always to an end, predetermined. The final cause is the determination to see. The final cause of the eye is vision. Matter can never be a cause. If matter were a real thing like the 19th century had thought, it could never have evolved. Always at the back of it is purpose, intelligence, with a functional aim. So where we find four, we're getting an establishment on the earth of an individual, five, the growth of senses, six, segmentation, sexual expression. That's the term of the fall. Then begins the climb up again. If you have fallen down to the level of segmental activity or sexual activity, the only way you can start climbing is pull yourself together and become a new kind of unity in which you play active, passive yourself, using your own spiritual force on your own body. You are then a seven, or even spirit, S even, equilibrated spirit. You balance yourself by taking charge of your own organism. Then you understand that that work requires reciprocal feeding, the inflow of the top into the bottom. You have to feed ideas down through the feeling into your belly urge and say to you, that's balmy. And it would say, it isn't, you know, I'm going to do it. It'll feed up again into the brain and say, you omitted to think about the sun. And so this feeding across the feeling zone of will into idea, idea into will, is that reciprocal relation of the eight. When you have fed this into this and this into this perfectly, then you are a magician. That is to say, you can make magic. Here's Ma, here's Ik. And you have gamut or grossly established that reciprocal feeding so that no longer can you be made to do something you don't want to do. And a magician is a man who produces things in conformity with his will, not in conformity with somebody else's will, his own will. And he can only do it by reciprocal feeding of primary energy from below, and ideas from above, and feeding them down and up, and resolving the conflict between the two on the feeling. He then becomes a magician or a negator of section. He doesn't fall to bits anymore. He won't let himself fall to bits, because he knows that only the unified will can accomplish its end properly. He is then equipped to set up an ordinal system. And the one is the I, the self, and the O is the boundary of the system. He defines the system very, very carefully. And he then says to himself, this system has a certain duration of time, so I'm making a system, a Savior for a time. and I do not think it's eternal, and so I will build up the business until it's nearly about to collapse, and I'll flog it to an innocent. That's the system. This is the kind of process that goes on, that went on in the withdrawal from outposts of empire when they'd reached the point of being ready to kick us out. Like an Indian friend of mine, who's in administration in Bengal now, said, "We will kick out the British." And I said, "We'll leave before you can kick us." He said, "Never." He said, "The British will never retire unless they're kicked out." And I had a little bet with him. This was in 1940. Now, he was tremendously surprised when he was wrong. The British withdrew. And I wrote on a postcard from the number 11. And I said, "Now look at that." And I explained the plot to him. I said, "When you're going to kick us out, we will leave the day before." Which is what we have done. Because we know that system means save you for a time. And we've got their goodwill now. Except some of them. We think we walked out at the 11th hour. And when we come back to 12 again, we can go right into the center, which we call the 13th point. We've got the governmental perfection, we go into the center. That 13 is Christ, the 13th man. Now, you know that 13 is supposed to be unlucky, because at the Last Supper, Judas was given a sop as a sign that he would betray, and told, "What you have to do, that do quickly." In that sense, Judas was number 11. That is to say, he was against the ordinal system that had been set up. The system was the system of the disciples in the presence of God physically. That is, God incarnated for a time, gave them a stimulus, and then he withdrew. And at the point of withdrawal, he said to one of them, the 11th man, "Now you go, and what you've got to do, do quickly, betray me." Because Judas is simply the word Yiddish. The word Yiddish, Yehudas, is exactly the same word, spelt in the same way, for those people you call Yids, and for that particular man who personalized and scapegoated himself, because it was now time to abandon the particular campaign which the incarnated God in the time process had started and carried to the term, when the crucifixion is the ratification. And from that moment, 11, one against the ordinal system. So Judas is always a betrayer. And immediately after he's done this, he goes out, and there are two versions. One, he hangs himself, and the other, his bowels burst in a certain field. Statement about bowels bursting is to do with his will not being able to contain itself. It knew no bounds. And the one about being hanged, you know, the head is important, is to do with this process of suspension of your thinking process on the Abhishekam. So they're both symbolic statements. Whichever happened specifically to him, maybe he went out and burst his bowels and thought, "What's a good amount of going to hang this on? I can't even have that." The important thing is to see that this process is the cosmic process, and you can go around it yourself deliberately, saying, "At what stage am I? Am I infinite? Well, yes, I am, really. Absolutely. Am I in the time process? Yes, or start here. That's around me infinite. That is where I am when I refer to my body. Am I this? Yes, I've got parts. I do think. I analyze. Am I there? Can I put two ideas together and synthesize them? Yes. Have I got self-will? Do I think I'm an established will on earth? Yes. Have I got five senses? Yes. Have I got sex? Possibly. Have I got some of those? I don't know. Maybe. Statistically, I'd say yes. Is there a reciprocal relation going on? Now, this is the important place. Am I feeding my will into my intellect, and my intellect into my will? If If I'm not doing that, I'm not yet eight. Eight, you see. Eight letters of the alphabet, H. In English, in all alphabetic languages, it's always the aspirate letter. In Hebrew, it's Chet, which is the English word eight. In German, it is Acht, which is eight. And the Acht man is the wakeful man. The Ak or Ek in wake. Notice in English, A-C-H-E, ache, is the thing that makes you wake. Pain, the thing that makes you groan. So, when the Germans say, give up, give attention. Spirit is consciousness. So you are eight, only if you actually are formulating your will and supplying your idea with drive. Now these two things are very, very important to understand. Because you can have a very, very clear idea that it would be a very good thing to do a certain thing and then not do it. You can have the power to do it down there, only full of potatoes and all, busy digesting. But if you made the special effort, you could gather it up, put it into that idea, bring the idea down to here and put it out on the arms and do it. And it is this actuality that counts. You have to get the will behind the good idea and squeeze them both out till they come out on their arms and do something. Then you are eight when you're doing that. Now you're only nine when you have done eight so long that it has become an habitual process with you and nobody can stop you doing it. If somebody comes in, turns the radio on, puts feathers up your nose, all sorts of balmy things like that, if it doesn't interfere with you, then you're nine. People will think you're nine, but when you're nine, then you can set up ordinal systems of temporal duration, like flooding a gold mine for releasing gold from the Welsh hills. That is gold in the Welsh hills, in certain places. And you can flood that system. If you have universal compassion, as St. Paul says, love, and do what you will. If you make a mistake and hate and do something that you will, you'll get into trouble. But if you've got this universal compassion, universal forces will guarantee your success. So, when you are certain that you can reciprocally feed all the time, and that nobody can disturb you, so that you're eight, you're nine, then you set up your ordinal systems. And then you're only 11 if you don't become involved in the system. So that you forget that it has a time. Now lots of people I know who have made a system in business have forgotten that it is a temporal system, and the thing rolls on and on and on, and every now and then, like a friend of mine in Farthest Oldham says, I should have sold this business, you know, about 6 years ago. It's going down, not up. I was doing wonderfully well. I should have sold it to ICI. Now, that was becoming involved in it, so that he wasn't really 11. Now, 11 is El, even. And El is the old name for God. The El Elohim in the Bible translated God. El is God. And El, even, is the equilibration. At the point at which you can see this system, this Savior for a time, has run its course and you withdraw. In the words of the Tao Te Ching, when the state is about to totter, the sage has already packed his bags. And then it goes up to the 12 and down into the 13th point. That gives you the whole cycle. And then there's another trick you can do with it, because once you are thoroughly aware of the processes, you can equate these with the zodiac information that you have and balance them up. And you can also say, like we said about the zodiac, if somebody's in the sign of the bull, they're going along bearing burdens like this. You can go into Scorpio. You see, you zealously attach yourself to something. You can play the opposite. In the same way, on this diagram, you can say, if a man has got unity, there's another kind of unity in opposition to him. The derivative individual. In other words, supposing we said that circle defines a business that a man has, there's a derivative of that business that he hasn't thought about because he's in an inertic state. The business is only one of the things that evolves. This is the dialectical process that Karl Marx noticed. And every business begets another business. And there are some fellows who specialize in examining businesses that exist to see what they are going to be put out of business by soon. Now that's the seventh of the one. Now in the case of this opposition analysis, the cure is this other kind of germinating activity in the eighth, reciprocal feeding. Supposing we cut the situation into two ideas, we say, take the colour problem. There are Negroes, or black men, and white men. Now, a Gemini would stop at that and say, a man is either black or white. But if we cross to the opposite, we say, a black man is white on the inside, and a white man is black on the inside. Van der Post did a book on this called The Dark Eye in Africa. But he didn't like to be thoroughgoing in his analysis, because he might have got stabbed, knocked on the head, or otherwise ill-treated. He said, inside every white man there is a black man, that is to say, a bad man who loses his temper. And inside every black man there is a white man, but the black man on the outside doesn't mean he's got a bad temper. Now, at that point, he's being illogical in his analysis. If he said black means lack of control, emotionalism, and so on, prime urge, dark intelligence, then he should say so. He should say the black man is black because he lacks self-control. In African dialects, the letter R cannot be trilled. They use L for L, which means link. The Chinese do the same thing. It means that they have not quite got out of ancestor worship, out of tribal dominion. If they can break out of tribal dominion, say tribe, it means they can say to daddy, I'll go to blazes, you're only my physical progenitor, you're not my spiritual ancestor, that's the abchim, you're just the physical doorway through which I came, and therefore you can go. Christ said the same thing. He will set son against father, daughter against mother. He's striking at this biological tyranny. So that letter R means to differentiate, make the differences between things. Where we consider darkness as dark intelligence, and consider, in the case of the dark peoples and the equatorial peoples generally, the heat has made their metabolism faster than that of people in the cooler latitudes, their tendency to emote and to impulsive action is more obvious than it is in an Englishman. So they don't carry their liquor as well as an Englishman does. The same amount. Simply because they're pitched low down in the body. This is Ham. This is Japhet. This is Shem. If you carry your intelligence low down in the belly, you are keeping it in the zone of primary urges and sexual activities. If you carry it right up in the forebrain, you're increasing your rational capacity by stressing it. So that if we said that is dark, and that is rational light, then we could say what Van der Post should have said, that inside every white man who is European rationalist, there is a bad temper if he loses his reason. But on everybody externalized and cast down and forward into the belly, there will be a tendency to be drifting towards the warmer climates, towards the equator. And we will there find those dark-skinned people, where there would be then a legitimate equation between dark-skinned and impulsive, fair-skinned and rational. But he didn't want to say that, because he wanted to go back to Africa. When we consider that kind of relation with perfect honesty with ourselves, then we can get somewhere. I've got lots of Negro friends. When we discuss this, and I talk to them, and they are in politics, they know it is true, and they can see it in others of their people. And many of them say to me they do not like to be ruled by their own people, because their own people rule less rationally in general than the big white chief. You can see that there is a difference. The moment you differentiate people at all, and you know that if you get two eggs out of the same woman, or two sperms out of the same man, They are formally different. Therefore, they must have different characteristics. Therefore, they must have different behavior tendencies. Therefore, we can say from first principle, the prime unity, once divided, tends to specialize itself formally in different ways. So we can say there must be such things as racial characteristics, racial temperaments, and so on. In England, we have a lot of bloods tied in, and therefore we tend to have a point of view that includes elements from all over the world. And therefore it's possible for us to balance more easily here than it would be if our ancestors had been born on the equator and we'd been born on the equator with them, or if we'd been born at the pole, where metabolism is relatively slow.
Could you say a few words on the planets, the two planets which you didn't mention?
It's only altered its external form in certain particulars, but its general principle is identical. In fact, those that even found a version of it by American airplanes accidentally flying over the South American forests, and they were photographing as they went, and when they examined the photographs, they found a colossal zodiac covering 300 miles, made of roads. And they didn't know that these roads were part of a big zodiac.
In South America.
In South America. Now it's connected with that fellow Contiki, you know, the expedition there. And they had the animals going round it. The 12 questions, and the roads were radially going to the centre. They didn't know that they went through jungles. From the air, it was revealed by the photograph. It caused wild speculation, actually. It made them rethink how old civilization was in South America.
You say it goes back 150,000 years.
In written form, on stone, it's 10,000 years old. In forms on parchments, it is relatively young, but on papyrus and so on, it is 6,000 years old. Quite a lot of time, isn't it?
May I ask something? I've seen that with the eyes. The ancient art of astrology.
Oh, yes.
The tarot cards.
Yes.
And one point he makes in it is the so-called constellations that make up the signs of the zodiac.
Yes.
They were only star patterns that were given for the benefit of people like mariners to recognize them. And that they actually consist of stars that are maybe many light years away in the plane. They just appear to be in that. And from that, he considers the types of people, the zodiacal types of people derived from that, to be absurd, because it was purely an arbitrary choice that the animal should be like that. You know what I mean?
Yes, it's a stupid book.
Yeah.
And he's a stupid man. And he started doing that to announce some other blokes at the university. Yeah. Two of whom, one of them you know, and two others there at the same time, used to argue like mad with him, and they were partially responsible for jipping him up to attack it more and more and more. And he makes quite absurd statements about it. And if he knew anything at all about scales of magnitude, the same argument would prove that he doesn't exist. When he talks about light years distance between stars that apparently make a pattern, supposing we devise a type of reverse telescope, like a microscope, which can see intermolecular spaces. Now, that's quite conceivable, isn't it? We've already got an electron microscope that can partially approximate to this, and it isn't the end. It's only the beginning of that kind of magnification. Suppose that we then make one of these instruments and stand Mr. Eisler in its beam, and we then look at him from the inside, what will we see? Colossal spaces, Mel Eisler, and little twirlings here and there in the distance. See, he's no idea what is called scale. The same thing exactly that made people think, oh, there are on the planet Mars there are canals. You see, things can happen. You get a handful of marbles and you throw them on a board haphazardly. And then you get in a balloon and go 18 miles around the world or something. And you go and look down on it, and what do you see? A pattern. If you ask half a dozen people what pattern they see, they'll see totally different patterns. Because you only see what you're looking for. But everything is there. Because all you do is you connect psychically the things that are there, the marbles, with lines which you yourself have in there. So we say there is a man in the moon. But the Japanese will say there is an old lady with a basket on her back. And the Chinese will say, there's a hare in the moon. And the Africans say, there's a hare in the moon. Actually, we know there are some craters there. If you like to think there's a man in the moon, we should think there's a man in the moon. Because we can count, and we're fond of counting. A man needs to count. So we say the moon is a woman. Because of a certain menstrual cycle. But the Germans say, der Mond. The moon is a man. We say the sun is probably masculine. We like to think that the power, the shine, the light comes from the male. But in German society, they say die Sonne. The sun is a woman. The light of the home is mother. Now, as points of view, if you understand that scale of magnitudes and consider what the Earth looks like to us, what it would look like if we ruined ourselves. Only 100 million miles away, what would we think about life on Earth? Could we see it? I make stupid statements about Venus and Mars, who are our nearest neighbours, a possible inhabitable condition, that we have seen no sign of life on. With what? They send a rocket up in there with a camera and it goes up 11 miles and photographs the Earth. Do we see any sign of life on it? No. We see quite arbitrary things and discover in the process things that we didn't know were there, are there. As a matter of fact, through ordinary balloon camera work, and also through camera work at fairly high altitude, we discovered archaeological earthquakes that we didn't know existed all over the world. Because the colour of the grass isn't the same if the soil has been disturbed 3,000 years ago, and there was a village there, you can see the exact pattern of that village on the photograph as a colour change in the grass. So they thought, that's a very good scientific method. Like all science, it's an accident. And after the fact, they go down and say, we'll dig where that mark was. And they find the village, which the camera showed, which the grass showed, which some innocent yokels long ago had said, you know, the grass there isn't the same colour as that. Why don't you dig there? And those fellows who were experts had nothing to do with the colour of the grass. You don't understand what we want. So scale is tremendously important. Most people don't realise it. That if you could just see a man with the eye of a fly, you wouldn't see a man. Think of the structure of a fly's eye, faceted all over. It's on your finger, and you put your eye towards it like that. What does it see? It doesn't see your eye. Can't focus on that. It sees a few thousand somethings mirrored in all the facets of its eye. What does it know about us? Practically nothing. Doesn't even know that we're the ones that go like that to them now and then. That's just an act of God. Unaccountable wind. Convulsion. Spiritual interference. Demonic activity. can't know. And in the same way, there are forces that man knows nothing about, because of the big gaps in his sense organs. History is going along finely, and something goes, and it changes. Nobody can see a cause. A cause is invisible. They can see an effect. But there's no relation between effects, other than the one you're looking for. So if you look at history and the scholars that have studied it, as many scholars of history there are, that's how many theories of history there are. What caused the French Revolution? It depends whether you're a Marxist or a good right winger. Scale is very, very important. But the most obvious example of that used by scientists themselves today, since the work of a French thinker, is an ordinary newspaper print which looks like a famous film star. And you look at it very, very closely, and it's only dots. You put a magnifying glass on it, and you can't see the lady anymore. You can only see dots, and each dot is solid black. You then put it back at its proper distance, and you think you can see grey there. Mm. But you can't. What you're actually seeing is solid black with space between them. There is no grey. Not on a newspaper photograph. So scale is very, very important. And Eisler ignored it completely. But he was seeing what he was looking for.
May we get Susan?
Yes, of
course. Going back in memory, I believe that when I was around about 14 or 15, there's lots of young people out there, I think. Quite quick-witted, trying to be cheeky. I used to stay with friends who were fond of doing that sort of thing. You know?
Mm-hmm.
What you call it? Kidding around with that sort of business. And I can remember that I once offended somebody that I didn't want to offend rather badly. And I have the feeling of having exhibited that. I now feel now that a certain amount of quickness of wit has deserted me.
Deserted you, or you have decided not to use it?
Well, having gone, it won't come back.
What do you mean, it won't come back? Has it got a will of its own? Was it your will to do it, or was it some other will?
Mine.
Would you like it back?
I'm not too sure.
Because there's a way you can get it back. If you want it back. There's a very, very simple way. You imagine that situation again very, very clearly. Can you recall it?
Yes. Not too well, but I can recall it.
Now, the thing that is inhibiting that quickness of mind that you then had is a desire not to repeat that kind of performance. What you did do was engraved upon your memory at the time. And along with it was engraved, this is not the best thing to do. So that the reality exists in your memory only. This you've got to understand, that your memory is a substantiated form, and that form determines your activity now, because that memory is now, isn't it? Mm. It's not then. It's a substantial state that was introduced then and has persisted and is now with you. It is determining your behavior now. So if we alter the form of the memory, we can alter the form of your present behavior. Now, you imagine that situation again, very, very clearly. Can you remember what you said?
No, I can't remember what I said. I remember who I said it to. I remember where I said it. But I can't remember what was said.
Right. Now, can you get a general feeling out of it as to what kind of a thing was it? Was it a particularly injurious thing?
No. The feeling I have about it is, as a boy or a youth,
having my leg pulled in quite a and general sort of a way, and myself getting the better of the situation, far too much the better of the situation, and feeling then I've gone too far and regretting it very badly, very much later.
Right, now this situation only exists as far as you're concerned in your memory, and it's determining your action now, isn't it? It must be, if you had a quickness that deserted you, because you decided not to use it again because it got you into trouble. So what you have to do now is imagine that person again. Now, will you imagine that now, as far as you can recall it? I want you to imagine yourself going to that person and saying, I don't know what it was I said, I don't know why at that time I did it, it had something to do with keeping my end up, but please accept my sincere apologies for doing whatever it was. Now can you do that? You're talking to that being in your memory. And can you feel that it's a genuine apology to that being?
Yes, I think I can do that.
Now, it's essential to get this feeling that it's a genuine apology to that mnemic being. And it's got to be made to that mnemic being for a very simple reason. That being in your memory is the being that you knew. It's not another being. Do you know when you have an idea of something? Is it an idea of somebody, or is it that somebody you've got in your mind?
I understood the question. Is it the idea in the mind, isn't it?
If you think so, you make a mistake. You see that thing?
Yes.
What is it? What are you looking at? Are you looking at this pencil?
I can see you behind it.
Look at the pencil, will you? Are you looking at the pencil? Or are you looking at an idea of the pencil?
So I was looking at the pencil.
You're looking at the pencil, aren't you? And it, when you look, you're looking inside your consciousness, aren't you? Because this pencil is in your consciousness.
Yes.
So there aren't two things. Namely, this pencil and an idea of it. There's the pencil in your consciousness. You call it an idea if you intellectually, deliberately remove the concept of matter from it. Can you see that?
Yes.
Anyway, now, if you look at me, it isn't an idea of me you've got. It's myself in your consciousness. Right. Now that's what we want to understand. That it's not a mere idea of another person. It is that person in your consciousness. And you have retained the only thing you ever knew, which you then call that person, and now you're calling an idea of that person. This is why you can apologize to that which you think is an idea. And then the person, which is the same as that which you call an idea, is apologized to, in fact, and psychically is changed at the moment that you mean it, even though they do not know that you have apologized. Because remember that there's no discretion, there's no separation whatever in the psychic and spiritual world. So this person is this idea, and this idea is this person. It's not an abstract concept. It's all you ever knew about that person, and it is that person you knew. Now you apologize with real feeling to that which you thought was an idea, which you now know was the person as far as you knew the person. Apologize to it, and you don't have to. You modify the memory record of your relation with that person. Then everything is restored. Then you take off the inhibiting factor. Because now the situation is put all right. Now, can you feel an emotive difference when you do that?
I think I can, yes. I'm not going to say definitely, I feel it.
Now, that feeling you've got is genuine. and it will permeate through those associated ideas in your mind, which are real, valid experiences at their own level. And then you'll find, without any hurry on your part, this quickness will come back, but it won't have that injurious element in it. But the fear will have been removed. Because nowadays you wouldn't do that sort of thing, would you? You see, you can play tricks on your memory, because your memory is a substantial, real power, the relations of forms within it being all that you call reality. So you're really changing the structure of reality when you make a formal apology inside yourself to somebody you have injured, so that they're no longer injured. So if you meet them, they cannot react in the same way to you that they would have done if you hadn't done this act now.
What has occurred to me is that when my father died, one of his brothers wrote to me and said, "We were never good friends because of the family failing," inverted commas, sarcasm.
Hmm. And where did that come from?
I thought.
Did you search for it, or did it come up?
Definitely came up.
Came up. Would it have come up beforehand?
Possibly not.
You see what happens? You release other energies.
Mm.
Now, consider this very carefully. When that letter was written, did the writer of it have a slight tendency to be pleased that the family had a power of sarcasm? You'd say that was so, wouldn't you? Sarcasm is a thing that those people are proud of, if they've got it. Now, why?
Well, a friend of mine said that somebody said to him, sarcasm is the lowest form of wit, it's better than no wit at all.
That's the whole point, isn't it? Your sarcasm means at least I'm bright. Because the pure dullard can't be sarcastic. So really, they were not ashamed of being sarcastic, they were pleased about it, because it was a weapon, it was a proof that they were, in some measure, alert. Now, what does it really mean for one individual, falsely identified with an idea of separateness, to find it necessary to use a wounding method against another being, which it believes to be separate, but is fundamentally identical? For instance, supposing you imagine a conversation between your tongue and the toe on your right foot, your little toe. Supposing your tongue decided to express what it thought about that toe. What would it say?
It would say I'm much more clever and articulate, right than you are, I suppose.
It would, wouldn't it? What would the toe reply?
A bit farther down the
air. Something like that, wouldn't it? And it could say, I can interfere with your best speech by twinging on a rainy day if I grow a corn, wouldn't it? Now, this is because you are one body. Therefore, you don't tend to insult your different members, do you? Now, a girl knows very well, quite an early age, by looking in her mirror, what are her best points. But she doesn't insult herself to herself. She merely recognizes certain things and said, these are not in fashion. I remember that when I was very, very little, my mother and her sister used to amaze me by the amount of stuff they put on their hips. And it was quite the thing to do in those days. You had to look like an egg time or something.
Mm.
And they used to build the hips right out, and they used to spend about 2 hours building the figure up. Now, they were not insulted when they knew that they were building up false appearance, any more than a modern young miss blows down an air tube here and gets a, what is it, 47 or 57. They don't think it's wrong. They say, that's how the market is these days. So, a woman can do this without that guilt complex that normally annoys a man, because a man is supposed to be rational, which is all the same with being formed. And form is limitation. It produces gaps between the forms, zones of nescience. zones of ignorance. A woman in that sense is not ignorant. She's innocent. She doesn't not know in the same way a man does not know. Because she's never aimed at the kind of knowledge that he thinks he wants. So she doesn't have the same guilt complex about certain things. So that a woman, if she made a sarcastic remark to another woman, wouldn't hold it against herself. She'd say, it's war. You see, women are enemies, one with another. Men are allies. In general, men, by being rational, are supposed to be able to relate to each other with some degree of smoothness. There shouldn't be excessive friction in the relation between men, should there? If there is, the men feel there's something wrong. But if women find themselves at war, they don't think it's wrong. They think it's right. Because they don't have that degreed scale of values that a man has, because they haven't left the will center and gone in the emotional center. This is why the thing that can upset one person doesn't necessarily upset another. What is a crime for one person is no crime to another. The important thing is to realize that in seeing that, you do not see an idea of the thing, you see what there is. Distorted someone, but what you see, you have seen, and it leaves an aftermotion inside you, which you call your memory. But the aftermotion is the original motion persisting. Can you see that? It's not two motions. There's not a motion out here and then something quite different going on in your mind. This motion translates through space, the light hits it, goes into you, and it modifies your substance, and that modification, being made permanent, is called memory. But it's the original motion that remains in the mind for you to recall. So you're not recalling merely a memory, you are recalling the original motion which once was a percept. And therefore you can deal with it as a present fact, not the original one. And it's a very, very good exercise to go back over your life if you want a certain amount of energy that's been locked up by you because it got you into trouble. Deliberately go back over your life whenever you can remember it, specifically when you go to bed at night before you go to sleep. Try to find out the errors of the day that you have committed with other people that you may have fallen out with or got a wrong idea of or condemned, and deliberately forgive the lot. And file in your substance forgiveness with every error you commit. And when you do that, you will not be robbed by you of the energy which you thought got you into trouble. It'll be available for you to make a fresh start tomorrow. And in the process, you have modified your relation with that being. And that being is a definite motion, part of which got into your consciousness. And your consciousness now stands as a link factor between your being and that other being. When you modify your end of it, you've modified the other end of it too. It's actually possible to make friendships up when enmities have grown without going to talk to the person, by making up your own attitude towards it, which modifies their attitude.
Relations of mine used to do, they used to be very fun getting together, a lot of them. Killing one another and having a bit of fun like that, and they would end up not speaking to one another.
Yeah,
huge would arise then. What did Lang say? Happy that I didn't want to be in.
Well, once you've understood what it's about, you know, because it isn't peculiar to your part today, you know. Actually, it's part of a natural tendency to disseminate. You know, if people were too fond of each other, they would never leave home. And how many people can you get living in two rooms? You know, the swans, when they have babies, the cygnets are not the same colour as the parents, are they? The adults are white, and the babies are the sort of nondescript grey brown colour, aren't they? Now, as long as the colour of the babies is not the same as the adults feed them. And the babies go trailing about on the ponds, and the parents keep an eye on them, and one day you see a white feather coming, and the parents. Is it a swan or isn't it? Because they have a very simple vocabulary. They say, baby, such a colour. Is he swan? White. And they they see, and they see five feathers, say, that's funny. That baby of mine's got five white feathers. And it's not quite made the greatest one yet, so we still feed it. And then one day, there's so much white there, he says, that's not a baby at all, that is sheep and wretched. And at that moment, the daddy turns around and he flies at them and he really knocks hell out of them. He doesn't do it gently, because he knows if he doesn't hit them hard, they'll come back. And on every pool, there's only so much fish. It can help the survival only of a small number of birds. So daddy really goes at them and he gives them the works. With a lot of beating, and the swans are the most amusing to watch. Yes, because of this wonderful colour change, and the way the parrots keep eyeing them. The swan, yes. And the day it is, they really let fly at them. And with a lot of banging and bashing and throwing of water, the young ones are driven away, and they never go back. Now, it's nature that does that on them. Nature is an intelligent, contemplative being, watching through all individual forms and making them do things at the appropriate time. And it does it merely by that process, we say. Consciousness is a catalyst. As soon as that thing fits a certain pattern in the spiritual world, the eternal world of form, a certain activity force is released through it, and daddy smacks her little ones. Nothing to do with the individual daddy swan. It's got to do with the cosmic swan saying, not enough fish here, send them off. And the same thing occurs in human families and causes families to fall out. Because if they didn't fall out, they'd stay in and gammon the place up.
It happens less in men than the animals.
The conflict doesn't. But men are always trying to rationalise why they should be harmoniously disposed in the same room. See? But really, if men were as kind and considerate and self-controlled as they believe they ought to be, there'd be more incest than there is, and the corresponding biological degeneration. So, when you can see that clearly, you won't be upset about that kind of dispersal of the family. You won't wait for a vow. You'll just go.
That can exist at the same time as brotherly love.
Of course. Because again, brother-in-law says, I'm leaving you some elbow room. Cool. Brother-in-law is a feeling, it's not an act. It's a feeling you have. You can go in and stroke your brother's hair hatefully. You wait. I mean, first smear your hand with bacon fat. Or you can just omit and look at him there with his hair all tousled and feel kindly disposed and know what to come to. It's like we said before, that before Christianity, brother-in-law meant a certain kind of tribal activity. Your motive wasn't important. And suddenly this question of motive was introduced. Not what are you doing, why are you doing it? And yet, funnily enough, if your motive is right, you'll do something. But you won't wait for a row before you leave, if dispersal is indicated. And the more conscious you become of those things, the more locked up energy in you comes out and becomes yours. And you can use that for some better purpose. See, when we're talking about generalities like that, to understand it and then bring it down to a personal thing like you put forward is tremendously important. We don't want to leave it at the universal level. We want to bring it down, concrete it, which we can only do in real bunged up civ work, kind you've mentioned, concrete, gross material situations, bring the principles down and see how they apply, and then release the energy locked up in the material body for better work. Because that is the meaning of the statement that man's function in the work is the salvation of creation. He has to wash, solve, wash the whole thing in that same sieve. And he must release from it all the locked up powers and put them to proper work. So the more specific problems you can find like that in yourself and then apply these rules to them, the more quickly you find yourself gaining in internal self-confidence and drive, and you can mark down your aim, you know what your absolute aim is, to become the perfect magician, in order to set up whatever saviors for the time will be indicated, and to go on to point 13 when necessary to say blow that one to bits, and then go around again, and always freely. His worship is perfect freedom.
And you lock up like that, can rob that.
He does do. It's continuously stealing off you. Very often a man feels, I don't know what's the matter with me, I can't work today. And really, it's something he did yesterday. It might be a silly little thing, a tiff with somebody. And as soon as it's out, he thinks, I shouldn't have done that. Then he becomes depressed. And he starts thinking about this fact, I shouldn't have done it. And he piles energy into the shouldn't have done it mechanism. And the next day, energy's going in, it isn't coming out. And it may be several days before he can refine energy to do his work. Because he's used a lot of energy to build a wall around himself inside so that he doesn't do that silly act again. But you know, not all of the stupid activities that men do are individual stupid acts. Some of them are imposed on individuals by the universal to teach them elementary humility and compassion. Mistakes are very good for us. They stop us being top-heavy. And the funny thing is, you can't pursue a mistake on purpose. So you've just got to wait and hope you'll make one. If you're very clever, you might have to wait a long time. It's terrible.
So just use
off the idea of the service. Oh, yes. Well, the more you find out, the better. Because you find that you've got more energy than you could possibly conceive. And at the same time, worry disappears out of you. Because worry is only caused by little petty rotations of unsolved problems. With energy going round in little closed circle. Next to it there's another one that's nothing to do with the first one, but it's going round near it and rubbing it. And it's that mutual irritation of small closed systems that is called worry. Worries are little wars between related factions.
I dimly perceive that because I've known I was a procrastinator, you see. And there always has to be a reason. Well, that's probably it, isn't it?
Lots of procrastination in people is a deep consciousness that if they start moving, they'll get into trouble.
Yes.
Or even worse, they might get into success and have responsibility. And then no time to turn night into day. Day into night.
You say, well, I could do that, but tomorrow.
This diagram is to work out proper relations like that. Those equilibrated relations, balanced relations. Suppose when we take those, remember we've already done this on the subject, but that was the prior to creation state, the absolute. This was its first establishment as an individual, and that was its direction, which alternated between establishments and the free again. Free energy and binding energy. And we can turn that triad round and see the relations there, because governmental perfection there, establishment of individual will, reciprocal relations. You can't establish your reciprocal relations unless you have established your individual will so that your original free force is under the control of the will. Only that way can you practice this reciprocal feeling of the infinite and the finite. And those geometrical relationships are quite valid. If you take a square and put that inside here, I say square, not because it's got the same size, the right angles here, this right angle. There's a relation between this individuated state first, the five sense life, the whole being that results from its integration, and the transcendence of any ordinal system. Now, if you make yourself work out with such a diagram, all the balance forms, you can put a square inside there too, and so on, because you've got these cardinal points, and you can connect them up like this, and see the relation between all those square forms, the rectangular forms, perhaps I guess we'd call that an oblong number, because he conceived that numbers were things, not merely properties of things. Any balanced form within that beauty, that beauty is symmetry. Balance. What isn't balanced is not beautiful for them. We may have another idea about it. But if we examine our idea about it, we'll find that it means balance, although of a dynamic order. Supposing a man is running along, we say, well, his body is not in balance if we compare it with that of a man not running. But if we add into the man who is running the force involved in his body, and the force of gravity, and see that he is not actually falling to the ground but running, the whole thing is in a dynamic equilibrium. And it was that the Greeks meant by symmetry. It wasn't a static concept.
The statuary isn't usually, the attitudes are not usually static on the moment.
No. And even the stillest of their statues is not a simple turnover symmetry, is it? Two sides are not identical. You can't find a Greek statue that you could cut down the middle and say that the one side is the same as the other, turned over. As you could with a man who was equally proportioned, standing with both hands to his side, his feet together and his head straight. That would be static symmetry.
I immediately thought of Discobolus when you said that. I don't know whether it even is Greek.
Yes. That's built around a spiral concept. From the disc. Which is the motion that he has to perform to do it efficiently. As a matter of fact, if you take the temples and statues of the Greeks in their best period and the temples of the Egyptians and take a pair of compasses, you can go over them and find that all the forms are placed on arcs described by compasses. It was done deliberately. I think you do not find in Chinese and other arts. In other words, they had a geometrical base for that art. In Gurdjieff's sense, objective, yes. See, an objective work of art you could define as that work of art that will produce an identical effect on all normally constituted people. And subjective art, it will produce different effects on normally constituted people. Of course, the most obvious concrete objective work of art is the universe itself, and it's highly dynamic.
It's almost subjective.
It appears subjective from the inside because it looks arbitrary.
That's a joke.
It happens to be a true joke. Joke is the same word, yoke.
It depends
how
you define your
term. It always does. You know, when you see, say, the in some of the climbing plants with a tendril that goes round a nail in the wall or round a bit of string. And you watch it grow and it tentatively moves from day to day. It appears to change its direction. It looks arbitrary. But the cause of it was very, very simple. While it was growing, on one day, there was a cloud came along. And the light was intense over there, so it started growing that way. The next day that cloud didn't come, but a very small boy came and for some unknown reason leaned a pole against the wall and cast a shadow there. So it turned that way. And every conceivable change of direction was conditioned not by blind mechanics, but by the adaptability of the will in that plant. In fact, you can make plants grow like that, and it's very interesting to do it. I made some miniature trees like that once by shining a light on them from various positions, and they start growing like that. And put the light over there, and they grow like that. Now, the oak tree was sacred to the Druids because its branches grow in a non-predictable direction. You take another tree like an elm or an ash or something, there's a general characteristic, and you can say, well, it will go like this every now and then. The oak tree goes like this, over there, and it suddenly goes like this. That was called unpredictability of the will. And that unpredictability was what the Druids knew to be the same thing as free, self-conscious determination. Hearts of oak, you see, means the same thing as jolly good twisters are we. Funny, isn't it, huh? And those things, you get an idea that hearts of oak means rigid. And the people that are fond of the oak, and the biggest twisters in the world. Druid itself actually means, it's Turish B nearly, means the ability to penetrate through the form and see out of other forms that most people can't see. Opportunities. In a closed situation, they see right through it.
Were the Druids developed?
At the time the Druids were in the ascendancy, people came from all over the world to Druid schools to learn the tricks and the trade. Their degenerate form in India produced the Dravids. Their linear descendants today with all the doctrine lost are the Dravidians. Their doctrine is very, very interesting because the name of their saviour is Yesu, identical with the Hebrew Jesus. And it only means affirmation, yes. So get on with it. That's the saviour. Get on with it.
Does it follow from what you've said now that the oak tree couldn't be made to take any fat by playing with lights?
It's very difficult from our point of view, unless we get a series of children to help us.
Do we want
it? It's worth doing, isn't it? Worth trying.
Have the light going round and upwards and go out of co-op school.
Well, I'd like to see the man that persuaded Oak Street to respond that way. Because there's a funny spirit at the back of it. You see, the oak tree is an objective precipitate of the original twisting spirit.
Why does the mistletoe prefer it to grow on?
Ah, that's the whole secret, you see, because the oak, which the Druids called dur, when it's all durable, it's the same thing as a wick. And that parasitic thing upon it, I don't know how to say this in public. I'll say Thomas because it's worth hinting about. The oak tree represents the man who is consciously able to adapt himself. And the mistletoe is a parasite on the body of that man. And that man knows that there's a parasite on his body. And he doesn't mind. Now, what does it mean? Now, why do people kiss underneath it? That's why they kiss underneath it. The Christians call it the kiss of peace. And the bishops in the early Christian church said, we'll have to stop this kiss of peace. The sound of osculation is disturbing the peace of the church. They had to say that to stop them. In the end, they said, well, if you kiss this cross, that'll shut you up. That's the origin of kissing the cross in the church. They found that the kiss of peace, as they called it, was in general preferred by boys and girls, or men and women. They found that when they came together to give the collective kiss of peace, there was some spontaneous turning towards the better looking members. So the bishop said, I will stop all this. So they first made a rule, men will have to kiss men, women will have to kiss women. But they soon found out that some of the men didn't mind this. See? So they stopped that. They said, all right, you can kiss the cross now. Mm. So they gave them the cross and said, kiss that, and that'll shut you up. And after that, the sermons could be heard better.
Because it was always very straight and tall.
No, but they're not, you know. It's only some poplars are like that. Lombardy poplar. There are other poplars that don't do that. They will split because of triangularity. Some of them, like the Scots pines, are a bit wiggly. Like Scotsman, they go like that. They're almost like Scots druids, there, so.
That's for making walking sticks, isn't it?
Yes. It's technically the original druidic language of tree significances.
Mm.
You didn't get very far with it.
That is.
Tried, darling.